Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Healthcare. It is Wednesday, April 22nd. And just to let you know, I'm not moving any bills today. There are amendments coming in, and we need time to look them over. With that, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 960. Zena?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 960 creates the Emergency Medical Services Personnel Licensure Interstate Compact. It establishes an interstate commission for EMS personnel practice as a joint public agency. There is no amendment, and there is no revenue impact, and fiscal statements haven't been issued.
Great. We have Senator Chuck Thompson, Paul Cook, and is it Jess Grove?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Anderson, Senator Shields, and Senator Canope, and the rest of the committee. My name is Chuck Thompson, Senate District 26, and I'm here today for Senate Bill 960. I'm here today with Paul Koch, who's a friend of mine and current acting director of Port of Cascade Locks, and of course Jess Groves, who's the Port of Cascade Locks chairman at this time. I've also been a volunteer fireman in the Hood River area for 33 years now, and throughout the time we've always had some issues with EMS movement across from Oregon to Washington with the Hood River Bridge there. There's and a lot of times these issues get taken care of with mutual aid agreements, but different laws, you know, with the Legislative Act, there's always times where a law passed in Washington that kind of messes up that agreement. A law passes in Oregon that messes up agreements. I know and Paul's here today to talk about issues down at Cascade Locks, what he experienced, because he was also the city administrator for Cascade Locks too. So I'll pass this off to Paul Koch, and thanks for hearing the bill today.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson and members of the committee. You have before you,
and state your name for the record.
Paul Cook, Interim General Manager, Port of Cascade Locks. So you're probably wondering, how the heck did he get from the city to the port? Well, what I do for a living is interim troubleshooting assignments, and I was at the city where I learned about this particular issue, and then we got a good city manager for the city, and then I moved over to the port. So that's what I do for a living. But here's what SB 960 does. The way it is crafted, it gives you an opportunity to blur the state lines inside the National Scenic Area, which I think is consistent with the National Scenic Area Act and the two-state compact that requires both states to provide services uniquely crafted to serve the needs of the National Scenic Area. 960 could also serve you in the entire state of Oregon and all the border communities who would have the same issue. So you have a copy of what's being promoted and being adopted nationally in 960. The simple essence of it is for Oregon to lift its current requirement for certification and training of volunteer and paid emergency service workers. If you lifted that requirement, then Washington trained, certified rural community emergency service workers could float back and forth across the river and plug in the needs as they are. As it currently exists in a little town like Cascade Locks, where you only have two full-time emergency service workers, if they are tied up on I-84 saving lives and someone in Cascade Locks falls in their bathroom with a heart attack, someone can come across the river from Washington, but because they are not properly certified and not properly trained by Oregon standards, and there is not a paid site commander present, that person cannot do anything. So we're asking you to support this. We also happen to think that the governor could administratively waive that requirement and those fees, and that would allow for a full integration of emergency service workers inside the National Scenic Area, which would be consistent with the two-state compact and the National Scenic Area Act, and I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much.
I think you said it all.
Okay.
Okay. Have you talked with the EMT people? And I forget, let's see, that would be Katie King is the lobbyist, I believe. Anyway, I think because we won't be moving this bill this term, if we can make sure that this gets to those people, emergency medical people, and I don't know if OMA gets involved in something like this or what, but it'll have more time for vetting, and those people should be at the table to look at this bill.
And this has been done in 7 states already. And, you know, because states all across the country are having these kind of issues.
Right.
So it's something that I looked up and found. So it's by the National Association of State EMS Officials. So this is starting to be done all over the country. I thought at this time it would just be a good idea to bring it up, and we'll start working on it this summer and get all the players involved and hopefully be back and ready to go next session. And
That's great.
This could even be, there are certain cases where a Medicaid patient in White Salmon, right across the river from Hood River, and maybe their hospital isn't capable of working, so they have to drive all the way to Vancouver to get the medical service instead of just being able to cross the bridge and go to the Hood River Hospital. So it's not just, there's other issues besides EMS that this could benefit, and so that's what we'll be looking at.
Wonderful.
Thanks.
Yes.
Senator, we did submit as part of the testimony a letter signed by 12 organizations inside the National Scenic Area, including the Columbia Gorge Commission, in support of this concept.
Oh, and I have it in the file.
Great. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 960 and open a public hearing on 2468A. Zena.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2468A creates standards for insurers, provider networks. It grants the Department of Consumer and Business Services rulemaking authority and specifies that rules relating to provider non-discrimination must align with federal requirements. It requires insurers to submit an annual report to DCBS demonstrating how the insurers' provider networks meet requirements. It clarifies the categories to be used in evaluating network adequacy or to use the factor-based approach, that the categories are to be established in statute and that the factors are to be established by rule. It establishes conditions under which DCBS is allowed to access insurers' provider contracts. There is no amendment and a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Does it matter who comes first, or should I just go down? Yeah. Okay, so we'll have Laura Kelly and start at the top. Okay, go ahead, Laura.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought I'd try to make it a little easier by giving a little introduction first. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Laura Kelly. I'm the insurance commissioner with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I'm here before you to talk about House Bill 2468, which relates to healthcare network adequacy for commercial market plans, so the health insurance plans that are regulated by the insurance division. I think that this committee is probably well aware about the complexities of health insurance and how difficult it can be for consumers to navigate their health insurance plans, understand what they're buying when they go to make a decision about a health benefit plan purchase, and then how to go about using their plan when they're actually seeking services and determining whether providers are covered by their network. So our concern as the regulator and the agency that's charged with protecting consumers in these situations is that consumers need better tools to understand the value of the insurance and what it provides to them, and a way to be able to assess that before they make that purchase decision. So House Bill 2468 is intended to address this in two key ways. And I think that those were mentioned by the committee administrator in the overview, but they're very important in terms of providing first minimum standards to insurance companies in how they develop their networks and assuring that they're adequate to provide the care that people need in a reasonable amount of time. And then also enhancing the transparency of provider networks so that consumers understand basically who's covered by their networks before they make that purchase decision, and then also along the way as they go to use services. So this legislation would require insurers to submit an annual report to DCBS and to demonstrate that their networks are adequate and that they meet the standards that would be set forth more explicitly in rule. And we're proposing a two-track approach, basically providing two options for insurance companies to demonstrate that they have an adequate network. And this is in response to feedback that we've heard really from all stakeholders about the need for, on one hand, a clear way to comply with network adequacy requirements, knowing exactly what's necessary to demonstrate to us as the regulator and to consumers that they meet the standards. And then on the other hand, recognizing that healthcare and health insurance products continue to evolve, a more innovative, flexible approach that would allow insurance companies to show how they're meeting consumers' needs and meeting a network adequacy standards, but not in such a rigid way as we might have experienced kind of in past standards. So the two ways we propose to do this is by allowing a factor-based approach, which would say that there are four categories of factors in which an insurer would demonstrate how they're meeting the needs of consumers. And these four categories would be access to care consistent with the needs of enrollees served by the network, consumer satisfaction, transparency, and quality of care and cost containment. And the precise factors that insurers could use to demonstrate how they comply would be defined through rulemaking. And then the other way that an insurer could demonstrate compliance is with a nationally recognized standard. So the example that we've discussed to date is the Medicare standard, which right now relies on time and distance. It might need to be modified to reflect the demographics of a commercial population. So, you know, for example, there might need to be more pediatricians, just to use an example. So to further define how these standards would work and the reporting requirements, the insurance division would engage in public rulemaking and define what the factors would be in the factor approach, and also to define which national standards would be allowable for demonstrating compliance. And the other piece I want to mention is that the adequacy standards in the bill right now are only proposed to apply to individual and small group plans. They're not proposed to apply to large group, and that's not because the department believes that large group consumers aren't really needing the same level of protection, but it is a recognition that large group products do function a bit differently, and large employers do make different types of decisions in determining how to structure their networks. And so we agreed with the stakeholders that we needed more time to discuss how this would look in the large group context, and so we've committed to keep that conversation open. But the second piece of this legislation is that it increases transparency by requiring insurers to publish a provider directory with regularity, and will establish what that frequency is in rule. The transparency requirement would apply to large group as well as individual and small group plans. So it would really be across the board. And, you know, in addition to requiring those to be updated frequently, we would also have require information on the directories that would show when they were last updated, and a reminder to the consumer that they need to check with their provider and their insurer, since there are circumstances outside the control of insurers for why a provider might no longer be in their network or may not be accepting new patients. And so just a reminder to consumers that it's important to double check that before going to seek services.
So would that be, the directory be public or only to those certain, well, it's individual and small group plans?
Chair Monis-Anderson, I actually have to look back at the bill of whether we specified how exactly that's going to be published, but our intent is that this is something that's available to a consumer as they're making a purchase decision. So really, I think that would need to be available to someone before they decide to sign up with a specific insurer, because they want to know if they're seeing a doctor that they like, they're going to want to know whether that doctor is going to accept their insurance. And so I'm not sure if it's specified here, but the intent is that would be public and available to consumers before they actually commit to buy an insurance plan.
Thank you.
And just a couple more pieces, and then I'll wrap up. So I just want to mention a little bit about the process that we used to get to this point. We've engaged with stakeholders really across the spectrum over the last year to work on this legislation. So we convened a series of public meetings with an advisory committee that included consumer representatives, provider representatives, and insurer representatives to really talk about how this should look. And we spent a lot of time going over the pieces of this proposed legislation and listening to feedback and finding ways to really move this forward. And so this legislation here reflects that work over a period of time. It also reflects continued work as the bill's been on the House side, as we've had to work through a couple of adjustments. And, you know, we remain committed to, you know, working with stakeholders as we move into rulemaking. There's a lot that still remains to be done in terms of how this will be, you know, specifically structured. And just to that point, there are a couple of pieces of feedback that I've heard to date that I just want to address. One is one of the factors that I mentioned was transparency. And I think there's been some I've heard some feedback that we might need to define what transparency means a bit more. From the perspective of the department, we think that the factors that would fall under transparency are exactly what we intend to address through rulemaking, and that we think that that's an appropriate place to have a discussion about what exactly are the transparency needs for consumers as they evaluate the adequacy of the network, and for us as regulators.
Madam Chair?
Yes, please.
I'm sure I wasn't paying close enough attention, Ms. Calley, but if I look at 2468 in the engrossed version, just for example, on page 1, line 18, it talks about the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange Corporation. I thought we abolished that, and that was the governor signed that March 6th.
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Steiner Haywood, that was actually where I was going next.
Okay,
that's another
sorry, I didn't mean to jump the gun.
No, that's quite
keep
all
going.
Right, but thank you for the segue. So
okay.
That's another comment that I've heard, and I've confirmed that one of the provisions of Senate Bill 1, which was the bill that abolished
right.
The exchange, is that basically when all is said and done, there's going to be a cleanup of the Oregon revised statutes to remove and replace references to the exchange, and that we don't need to do that in this bill. I think the exact kind of procedure there is not my personal area of expertise, okay. But my understanding is that we don't need to do that in this bill specifically. But if that does need to be addressed, we're happy to work on that.
That's fine, as long as we're not messing ourselves up because we're referring to something that doesn't exist anymore. So, cool. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Ms. Kelly, is it my understanding from what you're saying that this only applies to individual and small group commercial plans, but it doesn't apply to the CCOs?
Chair Monis Anderson and Senator Steiner Haywood, yes, the bill as a whole only applies to commercial plans, would not apply to CCOs or, you know, Oregon Health Plan or Medicare or other
right.
other types of plans. And specifically, the transparency piece would apply to all commercial health benefit plans, but the adequacy standards, you know, the insurers having to submit to us how they meet those standards, would only apply to small group and individual.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, I actually kind of ended up covering the last few points there through the questions, but, you know, really I just want to summarize by saying that House Bill 2468 is a bill that we think will provide Oregonians with better information to be able to make good decisions, good financial decisions, good decisions about their health care, both when they purchase a health plan and then as they're seeking to use services. And it will provide Oregonians the assurance that they need, that they're going to be able to access care when they need it. And I'm happy to answer any other questions that you or the committee may have.
Questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Commissioner Kelly, I get a little bit hesitant when we punt too much to the rulemaking process. And it seems like we've had a network adequacy rulemaking process prior to the session. Wasn't there some kind of group going, rules advisory committee going on this topic already?
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Shields, and so I want to make sure that we're on the same page in terms of kind of the work that the division had been conducting prior to this point. We had convened an advisory committee that was really a way for the division to propose kind of the framework for the bill and get feedback and basically be prepared to bring something forward to the legislature this session that had ironed out all the kinks. So there are many things where we've said we think that's kind of for a future rule discussion where we haven't We haven't yet gotten into the detail of how that would look. So we've been very mindful of not getting ahead of you on that. But we've made sure to gather feedback really across the board so that we could come well prepared to you this session.
So that was just an advisory group follow-up, Madam Chair?
Yes, please.
Not a formal rule.
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Shields, yes, that's correct. It was just an advisory group for the purposes of developing the legislation.
Great. No more questions? All right, stay here until we're done. Stay out there.
Thank you,
Barnes, Elise, or Tom Holt, Elise Brown or Tom Holt, Lisa Trussell, Jessica Adams, and I'm not sure who wants to come up. Well, let's let Happy Barnes first, then.
Oh.
No, and two of you. I want three people up here.
Thank you, Chairwoman Anderson. Distinguished members of the committee, my name is Happy Barnes. I'm a certified nurse midwife working for Kaiser Permanente in Southwest Portland. I'm here representing the Oregon affiliate of the American College of Nurse Midwives and as a strong supporter of this bill. I don't think I can speak as quickly as the previous presenter. As of 2013, certified nurse midwives caught over 20% of the babies born vaginally in this state, so we really do consider ourselves essential community providers and as such support the bill. House Bill 2468 will assure us of reimbursement and assure our patients, our clients, of access to midwifery care throughout the state. In 2014, the American College of Nurse Midwives conducted a survey of insurers that were participating in health insurance marketplaces across the country to ask them how they deal with certified nurse midwives. Only 4 of the 85 respondents were from Oregon, so I don't have a really good sample to reflect what Oregon's stance is, but overall it seems to be extremely positive. However, 2 items did stand out. One plan pays certified nurse midwives at a lower rate than they pay physicians for the same services. The practice is not based on outcomes or performance, but on licensure, a clearly discriminatory approach to reimbursement. 2 plans indicate they do not cover home birth services rendered by certified nurse midwives, even though this is a legal part of CNM practice within the state of Oregon. We've encouraged our state's insurance commissioner to look into these practices. And although the picture we have in Oregon is really quite rosy and based on limited data, we support this bill because the national picture is very different. Specifically, our national results showed that 20% of the plans in this country do not contract with certified nurse midwives to include them in their provider networks, even though CNMs are licensed to practice in all 50 states and the District of Columbia. 17% of the plans don't cover primary care services offered by certified nurse midwives, such as well woman care, birth control, antepartum care, and postpartum care. ACNM standards defining the scope of practice for these providers are often incorporated by reference in state law, which include primary care services. 14% of these plans indicated they impose restrictions on CNM practice that conflict with their scope of practice under the state laws where they practice. 24% of the plans will not cover CNM professional services provided in a birth center, and 56% do not reimburse CNMs for home birth. 10% of the plans contract with certified nurse midwives but do not list them in their provider directories, making them invisible to potential clients. 40% of the plans list certified nurse midwives in their provider directory under OB-GYN care, which may make it difficult for women who are searching specifically for midwifery care. 47% of plans don't contract with birth centers to cover facility costs. Despite studies showing good outcomes and low cost associated with these facilities when staffed by certified nurse midwives, 8% of the plans contracting with birth centers indicated they don't list them in their directory either. And for this reason, The Oregon Affiliated American College of Nurse Midwives considers a serious matter that a major provider of maternity and newborn care has been systematically excluded or discriminated against by plans participating in the insurance exchanges. We're very proud to provide health care for women and infants in this state. I'd also like to say we're very privileged to work in a state that's been very progressive in supporting midwifery care as an avenue for economic, I keep trying not to say low cost, for economic high quality care. I'm happy to entertain any questions you have.
Questions? All right. Thank you very much for coming.
You're certainly welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Elise Brown for AHIP, which is the National Trade Association, America's Health Insurance Plans. And AHIP and its members are here in support of House Bill 2468. And to Senator Shields' question about the technical advisory group, AHIP and AHIP members participated since the beginning of that, which, for your information, started back in August of 2014. So the point I want to make is that it's been a good process, one that has allowed for a lot of time and input. That stakeholder group was broad, and I think it leads to good things in the end. We do have a couple things that I know we'll be interested in following. I'll let my AHIP member to the right of me maybe talk about a couple of those, but we will be continuing to follow this process through rulemaking. Happy to answer any questions. Thanks.
Chair Monica Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Holt, Cambia Health Solutions. As others have noted, there was a very good and long process leading us to this point, and we're happy to be generally supportive of the bill, also happy to hear that the other bill on the exchange is taking care of the health insurance exchange naming in this in this bill. We do have one suggestion to further clarify, and it's in this list of factors that OID might use in rulemaking, and it's just providing a little bit more clarity around transparency. It's a great word that's become a bit of a Rorschach test in healthcare, and we think it would be helpful to the rulemaking process just to line out that in relation to this bill, that would include a provider participation in the health plan's network. It's a network adequacy bill, so that seems to make some sense. And secondly, another subject on which I think we've had a lot of conversation on another bill in this committee, transparency of allowed costs of covered services performed by an in-network provider. So we would at least provide some guidance on what the rulemaking would be on that subject, because it can mean so many things to so many to different people that it seems those are the kind of the two buckets where most of this would fall for purposes of this bill, and we think it would be a good idea to clarify that. But that's a technical change in terms of the overall bill. We're supportive of the direction.
Thank you very much. Questions? All right. Lisa Tressel, Jessica Adamson, Jesse O'Brien.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Providence Health and Services. Pleased to be here today testifying in support of this bill. House Bill 2468, as has been described, has had a long journey to get here. And we really want to thank the insurance division and the insurance commissioner for being willing to engage in that process. Providence operates in a number of states, and we have seen in other states not this kind of open dialogue with all of the stakeholders at the table to develop network adequacy guidelines and rules. We really appreciate that work and look forward to that continuing in the interim. We really are at the halfway point once this bill passes. The work ahead is equally as important in order to make that right. We also just want to say very briefly that we support the two-track approach in this bill. We think that will provide for certainty as well as innovation as we continue to move down the road of finding and developing creating plans that help to change the kind of care and develop an accountable care kind of system in Oregon. We think that this is important, an opportunity to both protect consumers and make sure that plans are open and available while allowing for different kinds of design. And also that we think that the current applicability standards are also appropriate, and we look forward to, again, working on the rules to further implement this bill and appreciate the work thus far.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jesse O'Brien, healthcare advocate with OSPIRG, which is the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. And OSPIRG also supports House Bill 2468, and I will be brief. I did submit detailed written testimony, but this is an important piece of legislation. It'll give DCBS tools that it really needs to protect consumers and hold insurance companies accountable for delivering access to needed healthcare services through their provider networks and making actionable information about those networks available in a timely fashion to their members and the general public when they are shopping for a plan. Currently, Oregon has very few consumer protections in this area, and I think it's past due that we take action to remedy that and get some rules in place to protect Oregon consumers. We have at OSPIRG been hearing from consumers with their problems navigating health plan networks over the past couple of years. In particular, it's been an increasing concern. So I look forward to passing the bill, getting to work on the rulemaking process. I think Ms. Adamson is correct that we're at best halfway through this process. But we think this is a good bill. It does in some respects represent a compromise, especially around the issue of the applicability of the standards to the large group market. We would strongly support extending the standards to the whole commercial market, but we are willing to support this bill as a step in the right direction. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Lisa Trussell with HealthNet Health Plans of Oregon, also here in support. I had a question mark on the sign-up sheet, but the commissioner has taken my question, so I don't need to discuss it here. But I did want to mention that network adequacy is an important piece of providing access to care, but having a network adequacy standard doesn't alleviate the supply of practitioners. So even though we'll be having network adequacy standards, that won't increase necessarily the volumes of providers in the state. And the second thing I'd like to comment on is that the for some of the carriers in Oregon, we would hope that we would have an issue with having to be in a position pondering if our network was of adequate size. So I think it's an important bill, a lot of devil in the details, and I'm also keeping track because this is the second bill this session that Mr. O'Brien and I have appeared jointly on.
That's progress.
more scary.
I'm still looking for my first.
I would, although I said at the beginning that I wouldn't want to, that I wasn't going to pass any bills, this is one that we could possibly pass. But I had had the same concern about the word the Oregon Insurance Exchange. But it sounds like from Ms. Callie that Senate Bill 1 will take care of that.
Work it.
Pardon?
Sorry, I'm being snappy. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I apologize. I'm just encouraging you. That's all.
Anyway, I have no clue what she's saying, but that's all right. I would like to know where you are at. I know Mr. Holt mentioned that he would like to amend the bill a little bit to clarify transparency. Do you have an opinion on that at all?
Madam Chair, Jessica Adamson, Providence Health and Services is comfortable with the bill as it's written.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, OSPIRG is also comfortable with the bill as it's written. I don't have any objection to the in concept to what Mr. Holt was saying, but I think the bill is ready to move personally.
I would be fine either way.
Okay.
We can live with it this way, but clarity is always good.
All right. Thank you. The last person is Dr. Jeff Clark.
Good afternoon, Chairman, committee members. My name is Dr. Jeff Clark. I'm a naturopathic physician providing primary care in Tualatin, Oregon, in a clinic I co-own with two other naturopathic physicians. Previously, I worked in Oregon High Tech and have a degree in computer science from Montana State University. I'm currently a board director for the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians and the first ND to be a member of the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Committee, which reports to the Oregon Health Policy Board. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2468A. So I just have a few brief comments to maybe underline, bold stroke a few thoughts. Insurers need to be held accountable to the state of Oregon for the adequacy of the provider networks that are included in the health plans that they sell to Oregon consumers. We do not want to have situations like have already occurred in California where people have purchased plans and have never been able to find a provider that was both in the plan and available to take them for an appointment. I think that's the main idea here. It is also essential, in my opinion, that we all be reminded that it is the state of Oregon that defines scope of practice and grants licenses to practice medicine, not health insurance companies. So the inclusion of provider-type non-discrimination language in this bill is an essential component that complements other state and federal laws that protect a patient's right to see the Oregon licensed provider type of their choosing for the covered health care that they require. Oregon needs all the properly trained physicians who are willing and able, and especially licensed naturopathic physicians, to be included as a meaningful answer to the shortage that we currently have and we project will continue to grow in the area of primary care. So that's
great. I appreciate you coming. Thanks for your testimony. Questions?
No.
All right. You're moving it? All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 2468A and open a work session on House Bill 2468A.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2468A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2468A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator
Harris?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Cruz?
Aye.
Motion carries. And Senator Cruz?
I don't care. Who wants it?
Senator Cruz will carry the bill.
Okay.
And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 2468 and open a public hearing on 2419.
House Bill 2419 modifies the definition of healthcare interpreter to include sign language interpreters. It revises the membership of the Oregon Council on Healthcare Interpreters to include a healthcare interpreter. It prohibits the use of the title Oregon Certified Healthcare Interpreter without specific requirements. It modifies healthcare data reporting requirements, changes Oregon health policy and research to Oregon Health Authority, modifies qualifications for public health officer. It removes reference to the Blue Mountain Recovery Center and aligns references relating to screening interviews and treatment programs for alcohol and drug diversion programs. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Yeah. Jan Lewis.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jennifer Lewis-Goff, Legislative Coordinator with the Oregon Health Authority. House Bill 2419 in front of you is a simple housekeeping bill for the agency. I can quickly walk you through the six areas of changes, but committee staff actually took most of my talking points right there. Section 1 through 5 are the healthcare interpreter cleanup sections. Section 6 and sections 21 through 45 do some statutory cleanup around our Office of Health Policy and Research. Section 7 expands who can serve as our state public health officer. Sections 8 through 20 remove references to the Blue Mountain Recovery Center, which no longer exists. Section 47 through 55 address Oregon's alcohol and drug evaluation screening specialists and Oxford houses. And I can go into more detail, but it is pretty much just cleanup, so I didn't want to take up your time if you don't need it.
There are questions about this?
I'm good.
Could you repeat what you said about Oxford houses?
Yeah, it addresses sections 47 through 45 address Oregon's alcohol and drug evaluation screening specialists in Oxford houses. Specifically, on the Oxford houses, the new language clarifies relapses in terms of eviction from the houses, and it clarifies what the statute considers as sufficient proof of a person possessing illegal drugs.
All right, no questions. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 2419A and open a work session on House Bill 2546.
House Bill 2546 defines inhalant delivery system, amends laws relating to sale of tobacco products to and the use of tobacco products by minors. It expands the scope of offense of endangering the welfare of a minor by knowingly causing the sale of tobacco products to minors by including distribution and sale of inhalant delivery systems. It adds inhalants to the Oregon Clean Air Act. It repeals laws relating to smoking in public that are duplicative or inconsistent with provisions of the Oregon Clean Air Act. It allows healthcare facilities to allow inhalant delivery systems on site for the purpose of administering medical marijuana. There's a dash A25 amendment, A27 and A29, and Elsie will be explaining the amendment.
Okay, I think Mark Mayer was supposed to be watching and seeing if he could come up here and would explain some of the, all of the amendments. But
there's his phone.
I think he'll be here. Okay, let's just be at ease until he comes. All right. Let's reconvene the healthcare committee, and Mark, it would be great if you could describe. I believe the only Senator Cruz submitted this 28s and 29s. I think you only want the 29s described.
Mine were the 25s.
Oh, yours was the 25s, and I don't know whose the 28s and the 29s are. Okay, well, let's start with the 27s because that's the one that.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, my name is Mark Mayer from Legislative Council. I was the drafter on these amendments. House Bill 2546A, 27 amendments, they're pretty simple. They provide for a sunsetted exemption to sampling vapor products in vape shops. The criteria for sampling is, again, it's fairly simple in this particular draft. The business has to hold itself out to the public as primarily being engaged in the business of selling inhalant delivery systems. In other words, they would have to be advertising that this is their primary point of business. They would have to allow the aerosolizing or vaporizing of inhalant samples only for the purpose of making retail purchase decisions. In other words, you can't go into the store and just hang out and use your e-cigarette. You would have to be actively engaged in making retail purchase decisions in order to sample. You cannot allow the aerosolizing or vaporizing of inhalant samples that contain cannabinoids, and prohibits persons under 18 years of age from sampling the products. So that's the engrossed, or that's the 2546A27 amendments. They sunset on January 1, 2017. So effectively, about a year after the normal effective date of a bill, this has an E clause, so probably about a year and a half or so after it becomes a law.
Now, it was my understanding that this amendment would allow persons under the age of 18 to be able to go into the vape shop, but they couldn't purchase it.
Correct. They couldn't use the inhalant. They couldn't sample the products.
And I believe other provisions of the bill would prohibit them, that aren't in the amendment, would prohibit them from purchasing.
Right.
But they could go in.
Yes. Underneath this amendment, they could enter the store.
They could go in and out.
And
all right.
Madam Chair, if I could, and this amendment was mine. It's kind of written in a odd way, but the effect would be that sampling could take place until January 2017 in the shops, at which point that could no longer happen because of the clean air implementation, right?
That is, Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Shields, that's correct. It does sunset, the provision relating to the allowance of sampling in vape shops sunsets on January 1, 2017, so that would no longer be allowed after a year after the normal effective date of the bill.
So the Clean Indoor Air Act would not be effective until January 2017, or only the sampling would not?
Only this carve-out. This carve-out would only be in place for that year or year and a half or whatever the time frame is, depending on when the governor, if the governor signs it.
But the Indoor Clean Air Act is still
correct. All other provisions in the bill relating to the Indoor Clean Air Act are still effective. It's only this carve out that exists for that period of time.
All right. Any other questions?
Not a specific question. No, thank you.
So, who wants to talk about any other amendments? I don't care.
I have one.
Because I think I just have these as yours, the 2829s, but I'm not sure which are people are wanting to
can
have.
Can you describe the 28s and 29s just so we'll know what's on the table at the moment?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Cruz, the 28s and the 29s are relatively the same. One contains an additional reference to the federal code. Basically, what they do two things. One is they remove the provisions relating to the Oregon Health Authority drafting or adopting rules related to labeling and packaging of inhalant delivery systems, and they replace it with references to the fact that these cartridges would have to comport with federal guidelines relating to safety packaging for poison purposes. So that's the first part of it. The second part of the 28s and the 29s is they remove the provisions of the Indoor Clean Air Act completely from the bill and replace it with a new section, which would prohibit the use of e-cigarettes in, for lack of a better term, circumstances in which you might find yourself near children. I think that'd probably be the best way to describe it. Indoor and outdoor areas, child care facilities, schools, an elevator, which I guess that doesn't really fit my description. And for outdoor areas, the real property of a children's facility, real property of a school, and a playground during certain hours if children are present. So
hopefully that does fit, because children usually like elevators. So.
So it really removes the Oregon Indoor Clean Air Act provision.
Yes, it eliminates those provisions from the bill.
Whereas the 27s did not.
No, they do not.
Yes. Okay. Any other questions about these amendments?
These amendments? No.
Yeah, just about the amendments. Okay. So I want to just open it up, since I'm not moving the bill today. We need to figure out what will move out of this committee, and so I need people to give us some ideas here.
Well, Madam Chair, I propose the dash 27s as a kind of a compromise between giving the vape shops complete exemption from from the Clean Indoor Act in their shops, and what the original bill is, just kind of as a way to phase in and make the implementation a little bit less troublesome to the small business owners who generally seem to operate these shops. It sounds like there is still a little bit more work to be done on this, and so I'm not going to move the dash 27s, but I would hope that the two sides can come to an agreement one way or another pretty quickly, because we put a lot of time, and I think we would like as a committee to move on from this. So I hope that can happen in the next day or so.
Okay. Senator Steiner-Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would say I appreciate the point about the phase out, but I guess I'm kind of uncomfortable with that long of a delay, and I'd be happier seeing something a little bit sooner, and I'm sure Senator Shields and I can have some conversations offline about that. But the other point I'd make is I've been having some conversations with law enforcement around tobacco and inhaled delivery systems and things like that, and they actually wrote a letter of support for Senate Bill 732, which was heard in Judiciary, to raise the legal age for tobacco and inhaled delivery systems to 21. This bill, and their concern was that that they were going to have a lot of trouble with enforcement, especially with inhaled delivery systems, now that marijuana and other cannabinoids will become legal starting July 1st of this year. And they're very worried that they're not going to be able to tell the difference between a solution that contains nicotine, a solution that doesn't contain nicotine, and a solution that contains cannabinoids when cannabinoids become legal. And although we did include provisions on tobacco at 21 in Senate Bill 663, which we passed out of this committee on Monday and sent off to revenue, I'm starting to wonder whether it might make sense, based on those conversations and based on the fact that we actually heard testimony from folks who testified about some of these vaping bills that we've heard in here, whether we ought to consider adding that provision to this bill as well. And changing the legal age to 21 for inhaled delivery systems. I recognize the points that some people have made about tobacco. People can go off to war on service of our country, but they can't smoke tobacco. But we don't have provisions around e-cigarettes yet, and our law enforcement is very worried, as I think they should be, that they're not going to be able to tell what somebody's inhaling. So I would like us to seriously consider an amendment to change the age to 21.
I think that would make it have to go to revenue.
There's no tax on it. If there's no tax on it, it's not going to affect revenue.
Well, what I would like to do, because I know that Matt Minahan and Jen Baker and Courtney Morgan Cowling and Reagan Gray, all of you have come in, and then we had a big stakeholders meeting this morning at 8. And so I think you have information. Jen, why don't you just come up here? And Matt, why don't you just come up here? Or whoever from the stakeholders that wants to talk. Morgan, doesn't matter. Okay. Matt, give your perspective on some of these things that have been thrown out.
Okay. My name is Matt Minahan. I represent the Northwest Vapor Association. The most important thing to us is the exclusion from the Clean Air Act to allow sampling in the stores. We're trying to get there with some of the amendments. Some of the things that we could go maybe even further on are we could look at not having 18-year-olds at all in the store. We would be fine with that. Like a separate ventilation system. There's some questions I have around that, and you know, in terms of the cost, and what if there was no complaints from the other stores, and maybe we could link it into if the other stores that were connected to the business were having issues with it, and then maybe that would trigger. We could certainly do that. That's basically really all we have left to discuss. The 21 and over, we're not necessarily opposed to that. What we would want to see, though, in that, and I testified in favor for that on Senator Monica Sanderson's other bill, Senator Steiner-Hayward's bill, we would want to see that match with cigarettes, though, because if you could now be 18 and smoke cigarettes, but not 21 until you could vape, that would, you know, and our view has always been it's much healthier, in our opinion, to vape and to smoke. We would want that even, so we wouldn't have a further deterrent to you know, it'd be easier to smoke at 19 than it would be to vape, and vaping's the healthier option. So we would not necessarily be opposed to 21, but we would want to see that at least equal, would be my guess. I'd have to check with my membership. There might be one more thing I'm missing that we'd be willing to give up, but no 18-year-olds in the store at all, we're fine with. Separate ventilation, we could probably get there. What am I missing? I think that's it.
Okay. Martin, Jen.
Jen Baker with the Oregon Nurses Association. ONA has worked on this bill all session long and is working really hard to get the bill out of this committee clean or as it is now, but open to having discussions with folks around what a compromise would look like. And I believe that there was a proposal being discussed earlier this morning that delayed implementation on the Indoor Clean Air Act altogether until the beginning of next year, and that is certainly something that ONA would be supportive of, to allow time for these businesses to adjust to the change in the law.
Thank you. Morgan?
Morgan Cowling with the Coalition of Local Health Officials. And yes, we also have worked on this bill all session and as a part of a work group that met prior to the session, and are very interested in seeing the Indoor Clean Air Act portion of this bill as strong as possible. We have several jurisdictions in Oregon that have strong local ordinances that don't allow sampling and are concerned about the sampling exemption.
I'm aware that the kind of the other compromise that was out there just extending out or delayed implementation of the Clean Air Act. We have no issue with the Clean Air Act. We totally get it. You know, I mean, if health risks aside, if it's annoying somebody when you're going up an escalator in Nordstrom's and somebody's vaping, they shouldn't be doing it, and we're supportive of that. So really extending out the Clean Air Act, you know, it's not a huge issue for us. We would much rather have a longer extension on the vaping in the stores than extending out the Clean Air Act.
Thank you. All right. Anyone else want to say anything? Questions? Rep. Taylor, do you want to say anything? Of course.
Good afternoon. For the record, Kathleen Taylor, House District 41, Southeast Portland, Milwaukee, and Oak Grove. I apologize. I was in something else, and so I haven't heard everything that's going on, so I just wanted to see if there are any questions of clarification or...
Just clarifying where you're at, and since there are obviously various ideas out there, you know, you might as well put yours on the record.
So the, again, I'm not certain everything that's been said or not, so forgive me for that. The idea, of course, behind this bill is to accomplish two very simple things: to prevent the sale of e-cigarettes to minors under the age of 18, and to make it so that we are treating e-cigarettes the same as regular cigarettes in regards to the Clean Indoor Air Act, which is something that's been in place for quite some time. As many of you may or may not know, the use of e-cigarettes among youth is increasing dramatically. The CDC just came out with a report that it's tripled. The concern that I think you've been hearing over a long period of time now from the health advocates is that we don't want to renormalize smoking in any way, shape, or form. Now, there's all sorts of folks that want to have parameters around e-cigarettes for a variety of different reasons. I think I was hearing Senator Siner Hayward talking about law enforcement, so they have their perspective. We've heard from BOMA on the House side when they came and testified that for people who own commercial buildings, so this is going to create a whole new set of conditions for them that they're going to have to work with. We've heard from the counties and from the cities that this is something their local jurisdictions are already passing and have already passed their own ordinances to manage how e-cigarettes are being smoked in public spaces. And then, of course, we've already heard from the health advocates. So I really encourage the committee to consider the fact that pretty much almost all bodies involved, and we've had a lot of people working on this, are interested in supporting this bill in its current form without any amendments. And so that's the idea behind it. I heard about the idea of extending the sunset, and I didn't quite hear what Mr. Minahan was saying, all the details about the Clean Indoor Air Act, Clean Indoor Air Act and the extension. So maybe if someone wants to discuss that, or we can have some questions about that or clarification. But the idea is that we just don't want to renormalize smoking in society, vaping, smoking, et cetera. We already have parameters around Measure 91 saying that we're not going to be allowing marijuana to be smoked in public spaces. You know, we're not going to be having marijuana dens. We've already decided as a body, as a state, when that was voted in, that we weren't going to have that. And with the vape shops, vape shops will still be able to sell the product. That will still occur, just like a liquor store sells alcohol. But we won't be the idea is to not, you know, we don't want to be encouraging folks to be using e-cigarette products. Nicotine is a dangerous drug. It's a very, very serious drug. And folks can become addicted to it. And what I've been hearing from folks is that we don't really want to have, for public health reasons, reintroducing, you know, e-cigarettes, regular cigarettes, any kind of smoking into society when we work so hard to kind of move away from that. So,
okay. Yes. Thank you, Representative. And the health advocates came forward this morning with a proposal that I think merits some attention. Mm-hmm. Basically, instead of the year and a half kind of phase in, about a 7-month phase in.
If
they're comfortable with that, would you feel comfortable with that if it went back over to the House for concurrence?
Based on what you've just said, yes. I think that a 7-month phase out, I just want to make certain that I understand exactly what that means. Again, it's so hard when you come from something else and you just kind of jump in. But I'll ask my colleagues to chime in if I'm agreeing to something that I shouldn't be agreeing to. But I think a 7-month phase in so that the stores can, what I understand is to restructure kind of their business model plan, yeah. Kind of thing. That I think would be acceptable. And then after that date, and it be December 31st or whatever the date is, of course, depending on when the governor signs or however it's written down, that way we know that it won't be the sunset and that we would reconsider it, but just that it will end, it will be delayed implementation, and we will not have the sampling in the vape shops. But for all other parts, there will be an emergency clause, and we will not be selling to minors. Hopefully, the governor will sign it quickly, and we will not be having kids vaping on school buses and inside schools and et cetera. And we can get that under control, and we won't be getting all these complaints from restaurants and movie theaters and et cetera of folks vaping in public spaces. So if that's what you're talking about, then I think that sounds reasonable.
Okay. So I think, is there any other vetting you think that we need to do? There are a lot of good ideas here. I certainly have made a list of things where another amendment will need to happen. So I think it's going to take time to work with the advocates and see what we can do, unless we can get enough votes to just pass it on the floor as is right now. So all options are open at this point in time. Thank you very much.
Okay.
No other comment?
May I say something, Chair Monson?
Sure.
Thank you. I just wanted to clarify that, yes, I would. I think that the Senator Shields, if I heard him correctly, and I just wanted to have confirmation from Senator Shields
that I did hear you correctly.
That can
be done offline. You shouldn't commit on public record.
No, that's fine. I just wanted to make sure I understood what was being said. That's all I was asking, if I understood. So, but we can talk about it later. But I just wanted to make certain I was grasping the concept correctly and that I wasn't.
Because I don't want you to put something on
record.
No,
that's fine. I just meant, do I understand what's going
later.
On? So, okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
All ready? Okay, I will close the work session on House Bill 2546A. I'm not sure when we'll bring it back. I think it depends on working with the stakeholders and what the amendments look like, making sure we have feedback from everyone on what the amendments look like, that type of thing. So hopefully it can be done quickly, but I don't want to rush this thing through. Any other comment? All right, we are adjourned. Any other comment? All right, we are adjourned. This thing.